Welcome back to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. As advisors to some of the wealthiest families in the country, The Rate of Change is a podcast designed to help you in the pursuit of building long-term wealth through the insights of some of the brightest minds in asset management. I'm your host, Murdoch Gaddy, and in today's podcast, we're joined by Ben Harrison, co-founder and chief investment officer of Altor Capital, which as of February 2024, has been acquired by Prime Financial Group. Ben's career began in engineering, project management on major infrastructure projects across Australia and Southeast Asia before moving into finance with Wilson's, where he worked in equity research, ECM and M&A. Nearly a decade ago, he co-founded Altor, building it into a specialist alternative asset manager with a focus on private credit and growth equity. For me, what I found most interesting about the conversation with Ben is what they're looking to achieve. It's not just another lending business. They want to get in alongside the businesses they're working with in both an equity facility and a debt facility and work with the founders to help access the capital they need to support the growth and trajectory of where they want their business to go. Their loans are senior secured, giving investors downside protection, but Altor offers the equity stake too, so it puts them on the same side of the table as management, giving investors a share in the potential upside. Their borrowers, the businesses they work with, are typically operating companies with 20 to 100 million in revenue, 2 to 10 million in EBITDA, looking for capital to expand, make acquisitions, or invest in growth. So as mentioned, then Altor isn't a property lender. They don't fund land, banking, or any property development. In saying that, the businesses which they lend to, they consider everything, all our hard assets on the balance sheet. So they will take in consideration property if it is a hard asset of the business, when looking at the overall collateral of the business which you're lending to. As of time recording, Altor's flagship private credit fund had delivered just under 12% per annum net of fees. It has a 7-year track record. It pays its distributions quarterly and has a target yield of 10%. We also talk about Altor's decision to join Prime Financial Group, why Ben did it, what was the goal behind it. So on a high level, Ben said it gave him the ability to scale, gave him access to infrastructure to really accelerate what they're looking to achieve. And he also really likes what Prime does. When Prime has a focus on sports and entertainment advisory businesses. And we quickly unpack, and it's going to be another podcast for sure. Prime purchased the Tasmanian Jack Jumpers basketball team in the NBL. And this shows how sports franchises can be treated as platform assets with strong brands, loyal fans, and multiple streams of revenue. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation. In saying that, before we get into this conversation, please remember this podcast is made for entertainment purposes only. I encourage you to listen to the disclaimer at the end of the podcast and keep your feedback coming. You can reach me at mgatti@ywm.com.au. So with that being said, hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. So sit back, relax, and enjoy it. Ben Harrison, Altor Capital. Welcome to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management.
Thanks, Murdoch. Great to be here, mate.
Good to have you on, Ben. Why don't we begin like we always do and tell everyone a little bit about yourself and how you got into finance?
Yeah, I started my professional career as a consulting engineer and ended up sort of moving quite gradually into finance, went and did a master's degree. And I think I realized actually quite early in my engineering world that the money was made when you were making money for your clients, and engineers sometimes are considered as a cost base. So it took me a couple of years. I went back and studied that degree while I was still in engineering, and did some time with Wilson's. So interestingly, saw them acquired last week by Canaccord. So I did cut my teeth at Wilson's and equities research and M&A and ECM. And then ended up moving out into the investment world as working for a small family office, and then ultimately established Altor Capital about 9 years ago.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Wilson's. I've got a lot of friends at Wilson's, and my wife's actually at Canaccord.
Okay, great. I mean, it's one of the great things I've found is that alumni network that it's been created out of Wilson's. So still regularly speak to a number of the people there.
Small community there, that's for sure. But that'd be very interesting, the size of that transaction. And but I'm wondering if that AFR article was leaked. I don't know. We'll find out what true numbers really look like. Good old AFR.
Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. So engineering background. Wait, did you end up doing any work in engineering before you ended up at Wilson's, or did you just do the engineering degree and then rotate into finance?
Yeah, I actually did a science degree in planning, and so I ended up working in project management more so than anything. So yeah, I got an opportunity to work on very large infrastructure sites, doing sort of project delivery, project management. I spent a lot of time working in coal mines as well. So I did a big stint in Indonesia, working in, at the time, largest coal mine in the world, doing a large infrastructure delivery there. So it was more infrastructure and planning that I was doing more than the kind of mechanical engineering side, but it was a very large multidisciplinary engineering consulting firm. And I think that's what got me the opportunity to think about, how things are working, I guess, within the operations, whether it's delivering on budgets and on project management, which is really what we do in finance. Really, we're project managers and problem solvers at the end of the day, and that's very much a project management discipline.
So then, through the journey, how did Altor Capital come to be? When did that happen? And why did you?
Yeah, so my business partner, Harley Dalton, I'd known for a very, very long time. He actually helped me land that job at Wilson's when I was coming out of engineering. So we'd kept in contact for a long period of time. At the same time, I left my previous employer, and he sold his business. He was one of the founders of DNR. Dalton Nickel Reed, or DNR Capital as it's now called. So he sold out of that was basically looking for something to do. So was I. We really wanted to focus on alts. We thought there was this is 9-10 years ago, we thought there was going to be an amazing opportunity to invest outside of traditional markets. So that's how we kind of came to be. And I think really it was very much like capital protection led as well. So Altor means protector. So how we kind of thought about the world, and we sort of saw an opportunity to kind of get more involved in the structuring of deals. And I think having a kind of M&A background and capital markets background allowed me to kind of think a lot about how to protect capital through structuring. So that was kind of very big. And then we developed a couple of different mandates that really focused on the SME, so that mid-market or lower mid-market corporate category, and developed an investment process. I mean, one of the great things having Harley on board with me was it being through this process of setting up a multi-billion dollar funds management business. So I knew exactly what we need to be doing on day one to develop, you know, a track record. So, you know, people and performance and process, the three P's. So as a fundie, that's the things you need to focus on. So we developed that very early.
It's interesting, the journey of alternative investments. Like, do you remember, like, when we were coming up, it was all pretty much like the 60-40 portfolio, everyone needed bonds, cash, gold, and well, that all went out the window with 2008, right? So yeah. Just how interesting is it, you know, the thought process now that you speak to a lot of advisors, like myself included, like it's almost pivoted to like core satellite allocations, but more like you have a defensive part of the portfolio than the offense, right? And before you have to have like Australia in there, but the world's gotten so global, you know, a lot of people out there are saying Australia is nigh uninvestable when you got returns double digits, you know, on the other side of the waterways. And But for people not familiar with, say, alternatives, what is alternatives? And where I'm going with this is, if you look at the average ASX return, it's something like 8% and a bit. Meanwhile, a lot of these alternative private credit assets, which, you know, you guys do as well, you're returning in the tens, you know, and the higher. So, you know, and it's potentially more stable because it's like asset backed, depending on what you're lending against. So it's really the evolution of it as an asset allocation. Like, everyone's using it to essentially ensure deliverability, and then clients actually get more protected instead of the whippiness of just holding direct equities. How fascinating has been that
this
asset class, the evolution of it?
Yeah, that's right. And that's, and you can speak to it more than I can, but that's the evolution of the advised client in Australia, really. It's gone to the days where people didn't have access to great, they might have had a stockbroker, but they didn't really have a relationship with a financial advisor. And that industry is obviously has really matured. So being able, you know, advisors being able to understand the other types of products out there that can get that right balance in their portfolios outside of Aussie equities and property, even bonds is probably not even sophisticated up until, recent years in terms of the 60-40 allocation. That was more a funds management concept in terms of, you know, the... So I think for us, yeah, it's been amazing to go on that journey. But what we saw was an ability to, you know, take a long-term view. I think the problem with markets often is it's very short-term focused. You don't know what you're really buying in terms of, you know, the arbitrage of the markets and the buyers and sellers and the behavior of such. So I think kind of bringing it back to a private market, taking away the noise and allowing you to think more long-term was really important for us. And also we're quite macro driven from an industry perspective, so we like to invest in businesses that or borrow to businesses that got strong macro thematics, really strong tailwinds. You know, being a business founder, we know that it's not always linear, so you got to be in the right sectors to kind of push you through those troughs when they happen, because they do happen. That's part of life.
So with Altor, what are the funds and what are the assets you cover? Because Prime's also associated with Altor as well, right? So you wear many different hats. So let's begin there. Yeah. Like, you know, what hats do you wear, and, you know, why have you chosen these asset classes, and what are the funds?
Yeah, so I'm the Chief Investment Officer at Altor Capital. We have a number of different strategies. We've got a private credit fund, which is our flagship strategy. It's a diversified private credit, corporate credit fund. It's been around for over 7 years now. That's strategy one. We've got an emerging growth fund, which is our growth equity strategy. And then we've got a recently formed fund in the last 12 months, which is a social infrastructure fund. And there's a whole nother podcast associated with that, so I won't spend too much time on that. And then the other thing we've been doing a bit more recently is a lot more in sports and entertainment. So we think that's a great asset class and a great industry to be investing in, a great time to be investing in that space. So we're doing a lot more of that, more so on sort of special purpose vehicles, SPVs, rather than in the funds themselves.
Well, just flag quickly before we get into the private credit. That's essentially how we met. So my cousin, Mark Arena, just purchased the Perth Wildcats, you know, nearly 12 or 18 months ago, right? And your guys at Prime, I think Reese essentially helped him with the buy side on that contract. We won't get into it too much, but that's essentially how we connected. So, and then
it was so often how a lot of us connect as well, is sports is an amazing, network of people that, everyone watches sport in Australia and everyone has a passion for sport. So it's amazing the connectivity that you get by being in that industry. It's quite impressive.
Yeah. And then when I, you know, caught up with your guys and like tested my cars, and I'm like, hey, so are these Altor guys, are they legit? He goes, no, they're fantastic. And they are, you know, they helped me really well through the process, with acquisition. So you guys should really have a chat. So, been enjoying learning about your firm. Let's go back to the private credit fund. You know, what are the mechanics? What's the asset? What are you actually lending against? Is it, I can't remember, is it B2B? Is it property? Like, what's actually underneath the hood?
Yeah, so it's a corporate credit strategy. We don't have any property exposure. And I think that was quite purposeful as well, in the sense that we, you know, a number of our clients already had quite large property exposure. So we wanted to bring to market something that allowed them to diversify away from that exposure to property. So we purely focused on that, what we call a lower mid-market category of corporates. So it's anywhere from kind of 20 to 100 mil revenue is kind of the sweet for us, the sweet zone for us, and anywhere from kind of 2 to 3 mil of EBITDA up to kind of 10 mil of EBITDA. We are what we call an active credit manager, growth manager. So I think, you know, I know you've had a few guests on the pod that focus on growth segments. So that's very important for us. And we talked a bit about that around the industries we're targeting. But what we are is also a very active manager. So we actually become quite actively involved in these businesses. And that's very, very unique. And what does active look like? It could be taking a board position. It could be helping them invest, understand how their business works. So it's like a private equity mindset, but we're obviously investing, you know, at the top of the table in senior secured facility. So to kind of answer the second part of that question, you know, we're investing in senior secured loans. Those loans are secured against, you know, assets, receivables, or cash flow. So it's not one particular asset that we're looking at. It could be a combination of, but it's very specific for, you know, the borrowers that are seeking us out. So they've all got a funding requirement, a growth funding requirement, and we're there to really design, you know, a package of capital that can basically allow them to achieve their objectives, and then we go on the journey with them.
So growth-based lending to businesses essentially is the...
Yep, exactly.
But you don't do property. Just quickly on this. Say hypothetically, you got a gym rollout, right? Or whatever it is, you know, a Chuck E. Cheese or Nando's. So what happens there if, say, a business is, say, on the retail or, you know, front-facing commercial shops when they have... You mentioned you look at different assets, but you don't touch property. So if you got one side of the business and they're looking to roll out and they want to do, I don't know, 30 stores, you know, for the next, you know, inside the next 12 months, but part of the business has another entity, which is running the McDonald's model where they want to essentially own the land, you know, and then, you know, put someone in there and get a lease and pay it all off, but you don't touch the property side. Do you help with that type of lending where it's essentially two separate asset classes, but you have to have one to have the other?
Yeah, I mean, if there's property or assets that support the business, then we'd definitely take security against those assets. So we're not, if it's an operating business that has a property asset, then we will take security over that property if it's not already encumbered. So yes, we will look at, but it has to be an operating business. That's, I guess, the key difference. We're not involved in, you know, developments, property developments, land banking, any of those things that, you know, our friends that run private credit funds, you know, they do that really well. We're not property people or property investors. So we really wanted to be quite specific around corporates and just sticking, we call it sticking to our knitting. But yeah, just focus on the corporate.
Nice. What returns is the fund delivered historically, and what are you expecting for the next 12 months?
Yeah, so it's done. Well, we can put the caveat here about, you know, historical performance and future performance, but, you know, we've done just under 12% for the last 7 years per annum after fees. And the running yield on the portfolio at the moment is around 12.5%, something like that. With the fund's targeting cash return of 10% after fees, that's paid quarterly. So there's two components to the fund. There's the cash element, which is the recurring interest income that comes through the loan facility. So that's a target of 10% per annum. But because we are active in these borrowers, we also look to take equity positions, free attaching equity positions in the businesses as well. And they're either in the form of options or free equity. and depending on the deal construct, they can be either or. But for us, and that's obviously not revolutionary, we've had credit hedge funds for many years taking options positions or warrant positions in businesses. But what we try to do is take outsized equity positions, but also back ourselves to create the value by working a lot more hands-on with these businesses. So we think that we've got a greater chance of actually delivering on the second part of the return, which is really the capital return, because we are very hands-on with these businesses. And we've now realized over five portfolio businesses where we've taken meaningful equity off the table for the work that we're doing with these businesses.
Yeah, yeah, let's really dig into this, because every man and his dog out there wants to land. Same in property, right? You know,
yeah.
But when it comes to the equity piece, people want to essentially land five or six, maybe seven times to develop a relationship before essentially the equity piece, however it's structured, comes into even the conversation, right? So I find that very interesting that you So are you the same? Do you have to lend to someone a number of times before essentially you consider the equity piece, or are you just said based on a deal by deal basis?
Yeah, it's definitely, and all our portfolio companies at the moment have attaching equity in some form. So when we look at the deal and the opportunity, we spend a lot of time working with the founders and the executive to, you know, find out, you know, what it is from a, like, we've got two parts to our filter in terms of the process, but first part is actually quite equity driven versus the serviceability and coverage, which is the second component of that process. So we really want to understand who are the people behind the business, what's the moat, all those things that maybe a traditional equity investor would look at. And then what's this business, what do they actually want to achieve over the next 3 to 5 years, and what are the key catalysts in the business, and where is that funding being deployed to help with that growth? And that could be acquisitions, could be capital improvements, you know, all those kind of typical growth scenarios. And then we sit down with the founders and say, all right, well, this is how we're going to help you. We'll give you the money, but it's just not money. It's smart money. Some people might argue that's not that smart, but it's money that comes with partnership and advice and help. So then we go on the journey with that founder and that management team and say, all right, well, you know, how can we do this, how can we do that? And we've got plenty of examples of what we've done, and I'm sure that will probably be your next question. And then what we ask for is, you know, equity, attaching equity to help and add that value. And a lot of the time, those business owners actually love having us in the equity stack, because it means that we're, you know, a really aligned partner. And then we can look at the total facility from a IRR perspective. So we can look at the interest income, and we can also look at the equity returns that we think are realistic to achieve. They don't always come to fruition, but we think it's likely that we can achieve equity returns or growth returns from those positions.
No, I couldn't agree more. Like, you know, if you're in bed with the business or both the equity piece and the lending piece, if you're just doing the lending, right, you know, you just want to essentially get paid and have the loan paid out and don't lose, right? But if you're in bed with the equity side, you have complete interest to see this actually, you know, go all the way. And I find that quite fascinating. And I think last year or the year before, I did a Southeast Asian firm, I won't mention which one it is, that specializes in, was it venture debt, right? So venture debt using warrants. Southeast Asia, but I think he was saying, and I was going to ask you as well on the risk side, that the deals that he was looking at begin at, was it 50 million or something like that? So when you're lending out, say, 5 or 10%, you only require it's the ability to say, if it all goes to pot, to sell off, and when you sell off the business, to get your 5 to 10% back on the equity piece, and you're still covered, right? So from my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, or please explain a bit better, that if you have the ability to do a venture debt style or however you structure it, the investors and the people they're investing with you in these transactions seem to be in a better position in the capital stack from a risk reward. Have I got that correct? Maybe you can do a better explanation.
Yeah, and I know the guys you're talking about as well, but yeah, for us, you know, we're not on the venture debt side. It's a, you know, more traditional kind of industrial type businesses. So financial services healthcare, energy transition. So all the really big kind of macro-driven businesses. But the kind of way that I would explain it is that you've got a contractual obligation, which is where your debt is, right? So that company borrows that money. They've got a contractual obligation to repay that loan. And there's obviously interest that's attached to that. And that income's great for our clients because it turns up every quarter and, you know, allows them to achieve what they need to achieve from a, you know, retirement or financial outcomes perspective. But we'd be also remiss to say that if we're going to be active in these businesses, and we want to be active because it's great to actually keep an eye on things, and that's a good thing from a defensive protection perspective. But we've also, our skill sets as managers have been very much more growth orientated and advisory partnership led. So how do we actually capture additional value by being more hands on with these businesses as well? And that's where that kind of equity enhancement comes from. So it's not necessarily taking more risk. It's actually about selling your value to the person who's, you know, borrowing off you, and then taking them on that journey and demonstrating that you can add value. And a really good example of that was a business that we lent to a number of years ago. The business, and we took a free attaching equity instrument as well as part of that. But when it came to the business being at the point where the founder actually wanted to raise a significant growth capital round that we couldn't provide, we actually ran a formal process where we actually did, you know, like a proper kind of advised M&A advice process where we ran our competitive process, setting up a data room, introducing parties, working on the financial model, the documentation, and didn't charge them, you know, a traditional capital advisory fee because we were aligned by value that we were creating in the equity position. And the founder loved that about what we were doing. He knew that we were at the table with him trying to get the best outcome, because we were going to generate financial returns from that equity position.
No, that is so important. So just jump in there, but yep. Like, yeah, I mean, I make stockbroking as well, insurance partners. How many times have we seen a transaction where the brokers get involved and all they care about is just getting their fee, and then they convince them to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and the only people that win are essentially the brokers raising the capital. But as soon as the money's done, they either flog it or something happens. Yeah. There's no accountability or, you know, interest in helping that business after they've done the raise, and it just ends up cannibalizing itself. And how many times have you seen the consequences of the actions? But no, this particular strategy which you have is fantastic. Plus, yeah, destroying the internal value.
Yeah, advisory is like dating, and what we do is like marriage. Like you go on, you've got to take a...
Advisory is like just going on Tinder.
Yeah. It's definitely a long... We think a very long-dated strategy. Like you have to. It's not... These things aren't... You're not in for a quick turn. And, you know, a true alignment and partnerships are also very important as well. So bringing those borrowers and founders and executive on that journey and adding real value. And we've fortunately now been able to do that a number of different times and developing, you know, a good reputation for that partnership approach, which we think is really, really important.
Are these businesses ASX listed, or are they predominantly private companies, or?
Predominantly private. We've done a couple of public companies. So yeah, we do both, and we're happy to do both, but primarily private companies.
So what can you talk to any of the businesses which you've done this for, and like what type? You mentioned a little bit about the engineering side, but what type of businesses are these? Like, are these telcos? Are these, you know, engineering firms? What is your bread and butter? Like, what do you find the majority of these asset classes are?
Yeah, so in terms of the portfolio at the moment, it's financial services, engineering and infrastructure services, and energy transition are probably the major kind of categories that we're in. And there's obviously subsectors to those kind of larger categories. So that's, I'd say, probably 70% of the portfolio, 75% of the portfolios in those three categories. And they're, you know, typical, you know, Australian businesses that have, you know, founders and, you know, need to have access to capital. But they're in industries that we understand. We're quite industry agnostic, but there's industries, obviously, we prefer because there's some macro around them, or we've got the skills inside and internally that can add most value. And that could be introducing, you know, relevant client relationships to win work. So we're at that level too, around how do we actually help these businesses with sales strategies, introducing them to, you know, key relationships that we have to drive revenue growth. So that's the kind of approach that we have.
So you say financial services, like I'm an advisor, and look, we've all seen the numbers. I think what advisors dropped from 16,000 down like 8,500 recently. There's been the tightening up in that financial planning space.
Yeah.
But it's just been acquisition after acquisition. You know, anyone that's retiring that wants out, all the young guys are coming in and trying to jump. And then, well, who's the other competitor? I can't remember the name. There's one other main lender that really likes lending in that financial space for, but if I'm understanding it correctly, is that something that you do? So if there's a large acquisition, well, let's call it a number, say the revenue is 10 million, you're paying 3x book, $30 million ticket. Is that, you know, for a large acquisition, we just discussed, you know, Canaccord's potentially looking at buying Wilson's, you know, not really confirmed yet. We'll find out how that goes, but that's a very big deal. But is that somewhere where you come in, that, you know, growth-based lending, looking at acquisitions, you know, is it just in the advisory space? Do you touch mortgage brokers? Like, just trying to get an understanding of. And the other reason I'm really digging into this, I find a lot of people that listen to this are actually people that own and run these types of businesses, and they might be actually finding it hard to find, you know, credit or the right partner in this particular space, and you never know what comes from these things. So I'm just curious, I just want to dig into what, you know, who is the right type of client in the financial services space for you?
Yeah, so that's, you know, we've got a business called WT Financial. It's actually a listed company. It's acquisitive. We've helped them fund acquisitions, multiple acquisitions. And, you know, we, interestingly, when, you know, we talk about, you know, why they don't seek out traditional, I mean, are these businesses not able to get access to traditional banks? We actually refinanced a Big Four as part of that that facility, and then gave the business an opportunity to get access to the right type of capital they needed to grow, because the bank wasn't there, and the bank is not there for a variety of other reasons around timeframes or complexity of transaction. So, you know, and I think that private credit managers have done a great job of really dispelling a lot of those myths around the types of businesses that they're lending to. We just have that flexibility to create the right product and the right funding structure that these businesses are after. So WT is a great example. So it's a, you know, dealer group, basically. Its whole premise is around how it can provide the right services to financial advisors, whether that's around compliance, et cetera. And, you know, we've been able to help Keith, who's the managing director there, you know, lead a quite successful acquisition strategy. So that is definitely something that we like doing. It's been a great lend for us and a great relationship for us, and we're, you know, looking to continue to support him with his kind of growth aspirations.
Does that also pivot into like the horizontal integration in financial services? I'm seeing a lot of things happening now, and like, you get an advisory shop or an accounting firm or mortgage broking, the whole one-stop shop service type routine is really starting to take traction. Like, clients are coming in and they don't want to leave. You know, you got a good relationship here, and, you know, why do I have to leave? Can it just all be in-house? Are you finding a lot of the acquisitions are they still keeping in their lane, or are they trying to do a one-stop shop?
I think it's probably a combination of both. I wouldn't say there's any one particular trend. I mean, we always are very cautious about, you know, synergies around cross-selling. I think that, you know, there's plenty of businesses that have gone before that have probably misjudged that, you know, that concept. So I guess we're quite cautious about focusing or thinking that the return profile is predicated on that. But yeah, we're seeing even other businesses as well that we get involved with are naturally looking for scale benefits as well. So whether they're, you know, buying revenue because they've got a larger fixed cost base or investment they've made in shared services, or whether it's other businesses that are trying to be a little bit more vertically integrated. I think they regularly happen, and the financing that we provide does help. It's not, our financing is not always about acquisition financing. I know there are funds out there that do, you know, specifically focus on particularly sponsored credit or leverage loans. But for us, it acquisitions is just one of many growth strategies that we would be looking to for our borrowers to undertake.
That makes sense. So in the other part of the portfolio, are there any other companies you can discuss? Like on the engineering side or anything? Or is everything's pretty much underneath an NDA and no one wants to be talked about?
No. Each quarter we give we give regular updates with the portfolio to clients. So, you know, the clients have that that look into the businesses that we're working with. But no, there's no, I mean, we've got, a business called Energy Build, which is in the renewable space. We've got a business called OnSpec, which is, an amazing business. That's more in oil, gas field work. So they work with all the large oil and gas producers, and it's that business creates basically like a tool, a monitoring tool that provides those customers with data to allow them to increase flow rates out of their wells. So we're leading a very, very strong growth capital injection for those guys. They've won some amazing contracts recently and have had amazing growth. So, you know, these businesses, they range and vary. But that's kind of a snapshot of some of the names.
With the oil and gas one, where are they, their main clients? Is it everywhere across Australia? Because is it data centric helping with the flow rates, or is it they just specifically focus on one side of the coast? Or
yeah, they've got relationships in WA, they've got relationships in Queensland, New South Wales, and then we've recently expanded into the US. But this type of, interestingly, they've been winning a lot of work in that hydrogen space as well. So there's, you know, greener energy, I guess, for those investors or others that are kind of more focused on moving away from oil and gas. You know, they are looking at expanding and doing work in other sectors that aren't so so emitted, I guess. But the benefit of improving flow rates is not only is production is improving, but it actually prevents a lot of flaring as well. So it does have some secondary benefits to emissions. It's quite a unique business, and you know they've been very successful. We've only been on that journey now for about just under 2 years, I think now, and the EBITDA of that business has tripled. Likely to continue a pretty similar growth trajectory over the next couple of years.
To give some context on that business, 2 years ago, what were the numbers? What are they today? And, you know, how have you helped? Like, I suppose some people wouldn't be interested to hear, you know, you working with them. What do the numbers actually look like for that type of business? Because it's a very interesting business. And also the TV show Landman's come out, you know, after the success of the, you know, Yellowstone. You know, he's come in and there was that particular thing where he drags the chick lawyer out in front of the wind farms, right, and just discusses with a point blank that, you know, everything is essentially petroleum based. Doesn't matter how you want to do it. You can't stick up enough wind farms and to do a thing. Otherwise, you know, these big oil and gas companies, they have them scattered everywhere, right? So we're stuck with it. For the people that don't like that, it's just a reality. People that do like it, it's fantastic. But how, you know, have you gotten in to help a business like this? And as you made a comment, you know, it prevents the flaring, which saves them money, but it also stops harmful gases getting into the atmosphere, right? Yep. So that is fantastic.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet, but it's definitely on the list because I've heard some amazing, amazing reviews. But I think it was quite an interesting journey we went on with that business, and it was actually referred to us from a client of ours. So that was quite a unique thing that we hadn't seen, you know, either. So we're actually seeing a lot of our investing clients, referring us businesses, which has been, you know, like an interesting change recently as well. But we did a lot of work. We actually commissioned an independent expert to have a look at the gas market. We knew ourselves that there was a need for gas as part of the transition to renewables, but we didn't have kind of the hard numbers and the hard view and the facts behind that. So we actually commissioned a report that looked at, you know, the policy settings, supply and demand settings, and we used that and also help us with thinking around the investment horizon as gas was being used as that transition fuel. So that was a key part of what we were doing. The business, we helped the founders buy a business off a larger parent company that owned. It was basically a business that parent company didn't want to pursue anymore. So there were a couple of existing management teams. So we basically did a management buy-in into that business. So we basically came in from scratch. It had very small revenue base.
What were the numbers? Like, you know, how big was the deal? What were the revenue?
Yeah, so the revenue at the time would have been probably 4 or 5 million, and it'd probably be up towards kind of 30 million now. So they've had some quite large...
In 2 years?
Yeah.
It's gone from 5 million to 30 million in 2 years.
Yeah, some of the contracts were kind of getting worked on in the background, so it wasn't kind of a full, you know, origination of that much revenue in that particular year. So a lot of it was being kind of incubated and kind of brought into the structure. And, you know, the deal terms were, you know, we were able to kind of buy it at a very, very low valuation, which meant the fund could actually contribute the debt to fund the growth, but also get themselves, or get the fund in there, and the investors get an equity position in it as well. So that's, you know, I sit on the board of that business. I work with the founders. There's two founders that I work with. And, you know, our remit is to grow that business, protect the debt, and ensure that, you know, the things that the contractual relationship that comes with that facility is continuing, but also how do you drive additional returns through that equity position that we received. And that was basically free. The fund didn't pay and the investors didn't pay for that equity position. It was given.
How much was the equity position? What percentage of the business did you get? How was it structured?
Yeah, so it depends. It'll depend on, like, we put an earn-out mechanism in place as well, so the founders get a right to earn back depending on revenue and EBITDA target. So it'll range, but it's a meaningful majority. Meaningful minority position in the business. But I can't give you an exact number because it'll depend on a whole bunch of different outcomes.
Yeah. This is the fun part. When you really start picking apart deals, how do they work? Why do they work? But what I'm trying to understand, so you got the equity piece and then you got the capacity to buy back. I love that because you incentivize because when you're an owner, all you want is equity as much as you can. And everyone knows equity is the most expensive thing to give away, right? So having the ability to work with a founder to grow and go, otherwise they get 3 years in and they go, screw this, I'm working for someone else. I'm going to flog my stuff and go, you know, build a competitor, right? But how good is the structure with the capacity? If you hit your targets, you get more equity back. Doesn't that really incentivize someone's behavioral psychology in their mind just to really, you know, roll up the sleeves and get stuck in?
Because it's a natural deleveraging exercise too. So if we can incentivize those founders to grow from, you know, a couple of million EBITDA, which was what we were kind of targeting at the front end, up until, you know, $4 or $5 million of EBITDA, that's a natural way of deleveraging the business as well. So you're willing to give up some of the equity return because you know that your debt position is not as high as it would have been when you started the journey. So I guess it rewards a whole bunch of different behaviors that we really like, and it doesn't work for every, like, this is quite a unique, these businesses are the exception rather than the rule in terms of what we would generally do. But there's a very specific set of attributes that we know works really well when it comes to these types of businesses that you can buy, you know, the founders can buy them well, they can use a bit of leverage to help them. They don't need to raise equity to fund the acquisitions. They're intimately involved in the businesses because they're already management teams. And they're willing to share in some of the upside for that contribution of capital. And you know, we were able to give them a lot of comfort about how we operate because we had other businesses that were able to give, like, you know, testimonials and those things that allowed them to, you know, that allowed them to get comfort about the value we could bring.
I got a question for you. Like, as a fund manager, you need a deliverability to clients. Now there's an equity piece in it, you know, people that have invested in this. Yes, you got the income component coming through. Everyone's happy. But in order to, you know, get the equity piece back to a client, normally everyone has to sell part of the equity, as you mentioned, have exits, right? Yep. But as the expression goes, you never sell a good business. You don't know what this business could be. You know, this could be a 30-year, it's oil and gas, right? You know, it could keep evolving and be a 200-year-old company, right? So what I'm just wondering is what are the other strategies, or do you have any other strategies that give the ability to provide exits without diluting your equity? And where I'm going with this, just been reading quite a lot, and I think we've been working with someone else who, because everyone understands about borrowing against assets like property, right? You can do that all the time. You know, you build one, let it grow, you refinance, take the capital and go to another. But it's very uncommon. People aren't familiar with it. You can actually borrow against equity positions in business, so you don't actually have a capital gains event, and there's no tax on essentially the borrowed money after it gets redone on the valuation. Do you consider those types of strategies, or is that too much risk? No. I'm just curious because, you know, it's now becoming a really common topic to talk about. Like, you know, it's pretty much how Elon Musk, you know, founded Twitter and X. You know, so bought it. You know, he didn't sell anything. You know, he used that capital to redo another business. So I'm just curious about your thoughts on that strategy, or if you consider it.
Yeah, we don't generally do kind of personal lending or all those. Like, we've always got to take a view that the business can support the facilities that we're deploying. I think the way we do think about exits and how do we get exit outcomes for the equity as well. Like, we're not perpetual capital vehicles. So, you know, the same way we think about. The contractual obligation to repay the loan, we also think about the contractual obligation for us to sell the equity if there is value there. So there's a lot of work that's done around shareholders' agreements in advance of deploying that capital as well. So we're thinking about how do we exit the equity position if there's an opportunity to, and that's, you know, first giving the founders a right to buy our equity positions off us before we run a process. But yeah, we are very conscious about the, you know, realizing the value for the equity as well. They're detached anyway, so they can, you know, you can have loans without with the equity being sold, which is a case that we've had with Energy Bill. We actually have sold the equity there and we still remain as a lender. So that does happen. Then sometimes we can be repaid the loan and still have the equity on foot. So that just continues. So there's no kind of horses for courses. It will kind of vary, but fundamentally we're looking to get an exit on yeah. both.
So I'm just running through the numbers. So you said it's 2 years, revenue's gone from 5 million to 30 million plus an expansion into the US, right? It sounds like it's on a very good growth trajectory. Why did you sell the equity off? Like, so you have no equity in currently.
No, that's I was talking, there's another business that I was talking about on spec. We still.
Oh, sorry.
Hold that. Yeah.
Right. And what type of business is that one?
That's the gas field services business.
Yeah.
Energy Bill was the one that we've exited out of.
Right. Sorry, that makes a lot more sense. I love the idea. You have one product in your house that generates income. Everyone gets looked after. Meanwhile, then you got the offensive end of town, and then, you know, you can use the income. I think I heard the other day that, and the math makes sense because I do it for my clients as well. We're using different fund managers. But if your client's got $1 million in over like a 4-year period, they can generate 400 grand. And then you can use that 400 grand to go offensive into, you know, deals that you're looking at. It just makes sense. You protect the downside.
Yeah.
Do you find a lot of your clients, you know, use the Altor products for that? They stick money in the private credit, generate the income, and then go offensive in your other funds, or how does it work?
Some investors will have, investments across the funds. I don't know the exact statistics. I think we looked at it probably a couple of years ago. But fundamentally they know what they're buying, I guess. They know they're buying an approach, whether it's, in credit or in equity, but fundamentally it's the same approach. That is growth orientated businesses backing really good people. And then being actively engaged. The risk profiles are different, and the rates of return are a bit different. Obviously, the credit's a lot more defensive, more stable type returns, whereas the kind of growth equities, more volatile, more higher return concept. So that's what they're investing in. It'll just kind of depend on what their objectives are.
Makes sense. Before we pivot to something else, is there any other questions you normally get that you find quite interesting from other people we haven't touched on the private credit fund?
Not particularly. I mean, obviously a lot of people are really keen to understand what's happening within the business as well, like where are the challenges and opportunities. I think a lot of clients like asking those questions to try and get like reads on, what's happening in business and the economy more broadly. So I think that's, probably a separate conversation for another time.
That is a very good point that they raise, because the private credit lenders, just like the bankers, are the closest to the coalface of figuring out, because. There's what people tell you at a barbecue, how amazing they're doing, but meanwhile, you don't know exactly what their finances look like, and, are we in a tough position and everyone's getting squeezed, or is it, pop the champagne and let's go for a run?
Yeah.
So how are you currently finding business right now? Is the economy buoyant? Is everything looking very positive? Is it a good time? Because the past 3 or 4 years, the private credit, especially in the raising space, has been quite tough. So where do you think we are right now in the cycle?
Yeah, well, I think we're certainly coming through more challenged period. We've had a number of businesses were impacted by wet weather, and one thing which has been quite interesting is the unionized workforce. We had one business that had quite a large revenue contribution from Victoria, and so they were impacted when Labor got in federally, specifically the CFMEU. That's the type of stuff that I guess you really see. From our perspective, businesses have challenges. Like we're not, we don't come out there and say everything's perfect. Because that's not the case, and I'd be lying to say that. But if, for us, because we are active, we can actually get involved, understand the business, help them out, so we can help them out if there's challenging periods of times, but we can also help them out if things are going well. So that's been one thing. Obviously, COVID was hugely disruptive, and as I said, this fund's been around for over 7 years now, so we went through COVID. So we're having challenges with, supply and access to supply, access to people and resources, all those things. But borrowing costs, are falling. I think we're probably, I'd say, through the worst of it. So we're generally pretty positive around the outlook for, small business in Australia.
That's really good to hear. Just on the risk side with COVID, have you had any businesses, not succeed? People, it's in the back of their head. It's like, yeah, we do these loans, but every now and again, it's just part of the business model. One will fall on challenging times, and then you have to help them go through the process, roll it up, or shift the business. Yep. Or has that happened in the past couple of years? And how did you deal with it?
We had this for COVID. Actually, we had an existing borrower that was a little bit challenged coming into COVID, and they had two businesses that they owned. We had to help them out for a number of months, and that that meant, you know, a few different things, but fundamentally we actually helped them sell one of their businesses, and that actually got the loan repaid. So we're able to work with them proactively and actually help them sell one of their operating businesses to repay the loan. So again, that's that hands-on approach. The relationship that we form with the management team is one of partnership. So when those challenging environments happen, then you're not shut out of the boardroom. You're actually invited into the boardroom and said, "All right, well, here's the challenge. How do we solve it? How can you help?" So that was one that was basically challenged. It never went into administration or receivership. It continued to trade, and we were able to sell the business, got repaid our facility. So that was a fantastic result. So that happens. Doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen.
It makes sense. Just conscious of time. Prime's, we haven't touched on Prime, or we can just do another podcast on it. What's Prime? How does it all work? And come on, like, you guys just helped buy the Tasmanian Jack Jumpers, the basketball team. So that's pretty freaking cool. You know, any basketball enthusiasts out there as well, like, do you want to give a bit of color around that, or we can always just postpone that to another conversation, but up to you.
Well, yeah, quickly, I mean, Prime Financial Group is our parent company. So Harley and I made the decision about 18 months ago to sell Altor. It was a very conscious decision. We, for a variety of different reasons, but what we wanted to do was really scale Altor aggressively, and we needed access to, you know, all the right infrastructure to do that. So we made the decision. Altor still exists, and we've been kind of moved into a different world now with Prime, but the relationship's been fantastic. They kind of leave us in the corner, and we get on with doing what we do best, which is investing. But what they've brought to us is a sports, very, very sophisticated, well-respected sports advisory concept that you referred to earlier. So we're working very closely with their corporate team to buy sports and entertainment assets, and the Jack Jumpers has been one that we've recently done and purchased. It's the first we've done about three sports and entertainment deals so far, and it's something that we want to do a lot more in, and think there's an amazing opportunity. These are businesses that are profitable, that have great management teams, that have got great brands. I don't know if anyone's been down to Tassie, but the way the fans just love the team, it's amazing. So you've got this great brand that supports the business. You've got a great management team. And then if you can look, we kind of think about them as platform assets. So you've got one revenue stream, which is five guys running around on a basketball court. But what happens when you extend that through infrastructure and facilities, through through a women's program where you can get scale benefits? So that's the way we're kind of thinking about sports. So we want to buy assets that are brands, but also platform assets that allow us to drive revenue growth and profitability.
One question I had in the back of my head, is the stadium owned by the Jack Jumpers, or is it leased from Tasmania?
It's owned by the state government. We get revenue from the stadium, not just the games that we play there, but the other events that are hosted there. So the P&L does reflect some stadium revenue, which is quite unique, particularly in the Australian context.
Yeah, that is unique. That's why I was curious about it. And for those fans out there that aren't really basketball fans, but you have done two other transactions. So what sports are they in?
So one in motor racing, and the other one was a picks and shovels business called Launched. So we've helped fund them and this is in our growth fund, but we've helped fund a couple of acquisitions, accretive acquisitions for them as they think about their growth trajectory. So Launched is the other business that we've done.
What's the motorsport one? I can't remember what it is. It's not Formula One, is it?
No. No, it's not public yet, so I'd rather not say. But
it's not public yet. Yeah. One for another day.
Yeah.
one for another day, Ben. Ben, it's been great having you on. Is there any thoughts you want to share with any listeners or anything on your mind that you think's a good topic to discuss?
No, I think that's covered a range of different things that we're focused on and really interested in. But I hope the listeners have got something out of the kind of active approach to credit. We think that is very unique and now has 7 years of success. So if people are looking for, and I think this is, you've probably seen this as well, like credit, in terms of allocation to credit managers has changed. 5 years ago, investors were probably allocating to one manager. Now we're seeing like equity managers, them allocating to multiple managers. So I think that's the opportunity now, is to think about, managers and their different strategies and how that can play a role in your alts allocation or your allocation to income or defensive or private credit.
One thing I want to just quickly cover is impact of falling interest rates on your private credit fund, because you've got the equity piece. So, we've seen it before where, some managers now who are targeting RBA cash rate plus 5, when rates went to zero, there's, a good mate of mine, he still managed to put out 6%, which is, quite fantastic considering. So what happened during the COVID times? Like if rates go down, how much of the equity piece play? Does it still just kind of tick along, sit at the 12% because your deals are kind of fixed in? Are you impacted by rate changes? Because that's probably one of the biggest questions a lot of people are thinking about, considering they just cut. So,
Yeah. So, the equity is obviously a bit different. There arguably is benefit to the equity is interest rate in an interest rate falling environment, because your cost of capital is falling. But so from a interest income perspective, we have floors in our facilities, so we're able to mitigate against or hedge against interest rate risk. So they're kind of floating over BBSW, but there's floors in those facilities. So if we see large interest rate falls, which would be good for businesses, the fund investors are protected against that. So I call it a natural hedge that's embedded into the loan agreements.
Just on that point, Trump's made it clear that he wants to drop the value of the US dollar as a number to attract investment in and jack it up again, exactly what the Chinese have been doing for like 40 years, right? Yeah. And you mentioned the oil and gas business looking at expanding into the States. How do you help businesses, cover the currency risk?
Yeah, well, fortunately, that business has only just launched there, so it's not a major component of it. But there's another business that's about 80%. It's an Aussie business, but it's about 80% US dollar revenue focused. So that we don't have any official kind of hedging in place, which is quite natural on hedging around, most of its production costs are in US dollars. Most of its operations are in US dollars. So it's quite naturally hedged out. I mean, we do talk a lot about hedging, particularly now as we think about funds and fund capital going more broadly, whether in Asia. One thing that we're very interested in is looking at the opportunity up in Asia, which we all kind of get a little bit focused on Australia, but really the opportunity is up in Asia and using Australia as a launch pad for that type of investment. So we regularly talk about what would hedging look like, but we're not that sophisticated yet that we're down the path of having done anything yet.
Actually, one question, this is just for me. What impact are you seeing with the businesses you talk to that do have exposure, into Asia? Say exposure into the US, they sell into the US, but now these tariffs are coming into play, right? And the expense and the cost. And I think I was chatting to a mate at one of the banks who looks after a very big one where 40% of their business was selling into the States and cost just blew out and they're all angry about it. But he's saying essentially, well, if you come, I'm just looking at the math, like, does it make sense that they move their manufacturing into the States to get their discount, or
are these businesses just going, well, the US is just not worth it? Like, I'm just curious, like, because you see this, you lend, you speak to these businesses. You may not be lending to anyone that has US exposure, but surely these people are coming to you going, hey, I've got a problem. Like,
there's two words that are quite often used at board rooms at the moment. That's tariff mapping. So there is a lot of work from executive teams really to understand what tariff impacts are having, and there's no science to it because it changes every day, and it is really, really difficult. But it's about how you understand how much your customer can wear, and it depends on if it's product or what kind of product it is. So yeah, it's definitely a big headache, and something that consumes some time of those board meetings where we have US sales, but only two businesses are probably impacted by it, and that's one in on the credit side and one on the growth equity side. But yeah, tariff mapping is a big challenge, very complicated, very complex, and very fluid.
From what you've seen, does the math make sense, them picking up and say moving manufacturing from, I don't know, somewhere cheap like Southeast Asia and then moving it to the States to get that discount? Does the math actually, that's what I'm trying to work out, right? You see this stuff, not me. Does that math make sense?
I don't think so. I think the view that everyone's formed is that if you're taking a long-term view, you wouldn't relocate for that purpose. I think that what we know is that we've been able to shield a lot against those tariff increases, so we've been able to pass them on, whether to end consumers or through the value chain to the end consumer. So I think the impact hasn't been as widely felt as the headline numbers that you're listening to or reading in the press every day. And it certainly doesn't warrant changing your whole strategy based on what could be, something that's, say, maybe medium term, maybe 3, 4, 5 years.
Right. So people are, sorry, long term, yeah. So people are speculating that, you know, how long is this these policies going to be in? But hypothetically, right, say the Republican House holds government for the next 12 years, and people may have made a decision based on, no, everyone hates it, the Democrats are going to come in and we'll be back to business as usual. But what happens there? Like, you know, that's making a decision based on a hope and a prayer instead of...
Yeah, I think it's definitely a two-pronged approach. You've got to understand that the implications to your business, the financial implications, and if you can get comfortable that, you know, you're relatively neutral, then there's no point making large strategic decisions to relocate production or work with different production facilities to get to avoid those tariffs. But I think fundamentally, no one's making kind of really rash decisions just yet. We know it's relatively neutral. We'll be quite strategic the way that we'll approach it and take it on the basis that we get more information. At the moment, it's so fluid, it's really hard to make long-term strategic decisions.
That's very interesting, Ben. I'm very happy that no blokes like you, so you can tell me what's going on, because this, you see this stuff in the papers, everyone's asking questions about it. You know, a lot of the investments that, you know, myself and clients make are all businesses that, you know, have these implications. To hear what's actually happening in the boardroom, that they're discussing it, but it's more like a wait and see instead of let's just do something drastic is very, very interesting. Very interesting, Ben. Well, Ben, thank you very much for coming on The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. That's been brilliant. If anyone wants to learn more about Altor or Prime or yourself, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Probably head to the website, Altor Capital, A-L-T-O-R. You'll be able to get a lot of information on there, be able to subscribe for access to updates and information about our products. So that's probably the best way to go. Or I'm on LinkedIn, so shoot me a note on LinkedIn.
And you're going to get like 2,000 people saying, hey, nice to meet you there. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on, and we'll catch up soon.
Thanks, Murdoch. Great to be here, mate.
The Rate of Change podcast is presented by its speakers. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker in their personal capacity and do not represent the views of York Wealth Management Proprietary Limited, its shareholders, directors, or any other third party. Any discussion of financial products, investments, credit, or property opportunities in this podcast is provided strictly for general information and discussion purposes only. Nothing in this podcast constitutes general advice, personal advice, financial product advice, credit advice, or a recommendation. Before making any financial or investment decisions, you should seek advice from a licensed professional who will consider your objectives, financial situation, and needs. Australian listeners can obtain further information about choosing a financial advisor by visiting www.moneysmart.gov.au. For clarity, the Rate of Change podcast is a business owned and operated by Murdoch Venture Capital Proprietary Limited. Any client relationship or referral that arises through the Rate of Change in connection with services outside the scope of financial services requiring an Australian financial services license, including without limitation, private credit, property development, or other non-AFSL activities, shall remain the sole property of the Rate of Change. Where listeners wish to obtain advice in relation to their investments or other matters that fall within the scope of financial services requiring an AFSL, the Rate of Change may refer them to York Wealth Management Proprietary Limited. York Wealth Management is referenced in this podcast solely in its capacity as sponsor. References in the introduction to the Rate of Change with York Wealth Management are sponsorship acknowledgements only and do not imply ownership or control of this podcast by York Wealth Management. To learn more about York Wealth Management as a sponsor, please visit www.yorkwealth.com.au.